This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Eitan Krasilovsky, Xander Evans, and Porfirio Chavarria. They're all from the Greater Santa Fe Fireshed Coalition. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So we're here to talk about something that's happening this Thursday, the 12th of May, at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center, and that is an event called What is a Fireshed? It's a public meeting where people can come and learn, which is especially important, I think, in these days of fire risk, drought, climate change, and the fact that although we are a city, we live essentially in a forested area, which is both a watershed and a fireshed. What is, first of all, what's our risk this year? What's it looking like?
Well, that's a great question. It changes all the time, and all the rain we've gotten in April is going to make things a little less risky than some years, maybe a little bit more similar to last year. Although there's always a risk, and human ignitions might not be necessarily driven by the weather, and those can start up at any time when people are careless. So there's always a risk.
There's also always the thunder and lightning. I mean, how do most fires start, wildfires in forests?
There's a pretty good split here in the Southwest. We do live in an area where lightning is very common. And as you just mentioned, often lightning disconnected from precipitation. So we have that dry lightning. So that is a very common fire start. But there have been lots of people here in Santa Fe area for ever, essentially. And people start fires as well. And so in the Southwest, we've seen both main factors being drivers of wildfire. Many of our most recent large fires were driven by infrastructure, power lines, Las Conchas, Tres Lagunas, and Thompson Ridge were all power line fires. But the start often doesn't matter because once the fire gets going, it doesn't really matter why it was started.
What is the kind of natural pattern of fires in this area? I mean, we've talked many times about the hazards of fire suppression and the wisdom of letting fires burn naturally as they've been burning since time immemorial. That, of course, gets harder when your house is in the middle of the forest. But let's say there were no houses here in this area surrounding Santa Fe, New Mexico, what does a natural fire situation look like?
Yeah, so there is, it really depends where you are in the forest. Closer down to town, we probably would have had less frequent fires. A little bit higher up where the ponderosa pine are, we would have had more frequent burns in the understory. And then as you get up to where the ski basin is, it would have been less frequent fire, more in the once every 300 years. So the spectrum really ranges from every, 2 to 7 years to 300 years.
In the same area, going up that same road.
Yeah. I mean, the traveling from town up to the ski basin is a great lesson in the forest types of New Mexico and the different fire systems that you can move through just on one short drive.
So walk us through that a little more specifically. You start at the bottom. You start at Fort Marcy. You go up the hill.
Yeah, so you go up the hill and the pinyon juniper woodlands start getting thicker and thicker. And as you get to the Dale Ball trails, you get a pinyon juniper woodland. And that has a highly variable fire system where sometimes it was every 50 years you'd get a crown fire there. And then sometimes it would resist fire for, 100 years, 150 years. As you move around 10,000 waves in Nun's Corner, you get into a ponderosa pine type system. And that system we know from carbon dating of bogs and from tree rings that those areas burned every, 3 to 10 years pretty regularly and maintained a more open forest. And that system continues as you go through Hyde Park. And as you get above Hyde Park, you get into the mixed conifer. And that still has ponderosa pine in it, but is wetter. And about every 15 to 30 years, you would have a fire in that system.
Why is it wetter?
So the higher elevation captures more of our snowpack and rain. And it also has cooler temperatures higher up on the mountain. So as we continue, and as you head to Big Tisuke, you kind of start exiting the mixed conifer at Big Tisuke. And from Big Tisuke up, you kind of have the spruce fir forest type. And that was a stand replacing fire type of about every 300 years. And I think the ski area burned around the turn of the last century, around 1900. So that recently burned and has regrown and is not considered out of whack, so to speak.
Right.
It's really the stuff from Big Tisuke down to 10,000 Waves that's our most fire-prone system.
And is that what you would consider out of whack?
Yeah, definitely.
And why is that? I mean, just because people have built there?
So a lot of it has to do with fire suppression. The last 120 years, we've been really good at putting out fires. We've had the 10 a.m. policy at the Forest Service, which was very effective.
10 a.m. policy?
Yeah, so that was that as soon as smoke was reported, the fire needed to be put out by 10 a.m. that day. So we have a very good fire service that is able to find fires after lightning storms or ignitions, go in and put them out. So we did that.
They get up very early.
Yeah. and they're really good at it. And so that every time you put out a fire, you allow all the seedlings and other sticks in the forest to build up over time. So we've had 100 years, 120 years of buildup of these fuels. Firefighters call them fuels because it's all flammable. And it's part of the fire triangle of how things burn.
So now here we are with this out of whack system. What can we do about it? What particularly can homeowners, neighborhood associations, as well as public entities do about it?
Well, I think public neighborhoods and homeowners, what they can do as far as protecting their property is pretty, easy to do. You just kind of have to walk around your property and start looking at what's the vegetation type and what can you do to mitigate some of the vegetation so that it's not continuous fuels all the way up to your property. And then look at around and see what's flammable around, right around your house, like 3 to 5 feet around it. And what can you remove out of that part of it that would, if an ember landed on there, because most of these houses that you see starting on fires, like in Las Conchas and Cerro Grande and all these fires where they've burned a lot of homes, it's the embers that land on the doorstep that starts the grass broom on fire and then starts the wood frame on fire on the doorstep and then it starts the house on fire. It's really those types of things that people can do to just reduce their risk. And the city offers services where we can go out and educate property owners and walk around with them and discuss what they can and cannot and what they could do to reduce their risk.
Is that something that's going to be available at this event on Thursday?
Well, I think, yeah, it's certainly going to be talked about and what we offer, and people can make appointments with me and we can go out there and look at their property. As far as what I think homeowners can do on this larger area, where Eitan was talking about this ponderosa forest type where it expects frequent fire. It really wants frequent fire, 5 to 7 years, 10 years. It's really supporting that effort to reintroduce fire onto that landscape because it's a fire-dependent landscape. Those ponderosa trees are adapted to fire and really would like that, fire to run through underneath their canopies.
What happens ecologically when that fire isn't there? Like, what goes out of whack?
All the seedlings start growing and all the debris from the needles starts accumulating. So you got big duff layers or, large accumulations of fine fuels underneath the trees. And then you have a lot of seedlings that are growing really tightly together. So in an area where maybe you had 80 to 120 trees per acre growing, Now you've got like 2,000 trees growing.
Oh my goodness.
So there's a big difference on, and it really changes the way while it affects the wildlife and the stream courses and the water available and everything else and the competition.
Because they suck up so much water.
Yeah, and each individual tree is less healthy. None of the trees can get their full meal of water and nutrients. And so when you walk into one of these very dense ponderosa pine forests that hasn't seen fire, many of the trees are sickly. And sometimes it's hard to gauge that because many of us have grown up in an environment where that's most common. And so that's what maybe we're used to. But in fact, when you are able to compare it to stands, forest areas that are more like they were naturally, you suddenly adjust your eye to say, oh, wait a minute, these thick stands are really unhealthy. You see more bark beetle activity. You see more sort of bent over, sickly trees that aren't able to reach up to the sky and play their full role as mature ponderosa pines.
It's like a bunch of people with not enough food.
Yeah, I was going to make that analogy, but it's a little gruesome. But yes, that is a good analogy. Yeah.
There's also a lack of biodiversity in these fire-excluded forests. So if you were to walk into them, say, you know, go up to Hyde Park and walk into the forest a bit where they haven't done any treatments, the forest floor is all covered in needles and there's no grasses, no wildflowers. And so a lot of the biodiversity of ponderosa pine forests and plants is in the understory. So when it's filled up with little seedlings and sickly trees and pine needles on the ground, you don't have that biodiversity.
How does the activity called tree thinning, where people go in and cut down excessive trees in a forest, compare to natural fire in terms of getting the system back into a kind of more natural state?
So tree thinning is really important to do where you can do it, where there's access, because without doing that and just introducing fire, you run the risk of having an out-of-control fire. Tree thinning also selects trees that you want and selects trees that you don't want. So the ones you don't want, you cut, and the ones you want to keep because they're good for wildlife, they have good visual characteristics, or they're going to live a long life, which is really important given the risk of climate change to our forests. You can make all those decisions with a chainsaw or a machine. But where you can't access the forest, you have to think about using fire to thin out these forests. And fire is a little more blunt than a chainsaw, but it also has a lot of benefits because it's an ecological process.
One of the things that happens when you have fire is that the nutrients, essentially, that were in the wood, in the fuel, as you call it, goes back into the ground and then is used by sort of the next generation of plant life. What happens when you thin?
Some of that material is removed, but if we're thinking about a tree, most of the nutrients are actually in the needles and the finer material, the smaller material. So the bole of the tree has much lower concentration. And in our ponderosa pine forest, nutrients are not probably the limiting factor. It's usually moisture. So even if we're in one entry, we might be pulling out some of, say, in a timber harvest, which is usually not what we're talking about in these cases, you may be pulling out some small fraction of the nutrients, but it really has no impact on the long-term viability of the stand. There are other cases in other parts of the country where you have much faster rotations and this is a bigger issue, but leaving the needles on site, it's really not, at least the research suggests that it's just not something we need to be concerned with.
Well, and I also think that if you're going to thin an area, then you need to be burning the area after. I mean, if you're really looking at forest health and, you know, reintroducing fire into an area, thinning is a means to an end into reintroducing that fire so that you can conduct prescribed burns in a more effective and safe manner so that you don't have these escapes or you don't have a fire that's not meeting the objectives that you want to accomplish within that forest, in that forest, because all these prescribed burns have objectives that they're trying to meet. They want to reduce the fuel by 80%, and they want to only take, half an inch off the top soil, not off the top soil, but off the top of those needle cast and retain topsoil. There's, a whole host of objectives and kind of checklists of things that, what are you trying to accomplish with those burns? They're not just putting fire on the landscape willy-nilly.
Well, if you have an objective for some of the things you said, and you were going to burn an area, why would you bother to thin it first? Why wouldn't you just
Because you may not meet, you may not be able to meet those objectives if it wasn't thin before. So you may have you'll have a higher concentration of standing fuels, and in an area where it's going to end up in the tops of the trees, and then you'll have some control issues where you won't be able to manage that fire. Whereas if you kind of cut it and bring the fuels down to the forest floor and put them in piles first, possibly, or scatter them about, instead of having an aerial kind of fire where it's up in the tops of the trees, you'll have more of a surface fire right on the ground that's easily manageable. And depending on what kind of prescribed burn you're conducting, whether it's a broadcast burn like across the landscape, or pile burn, which is just individual piles, which are very easily to control. You just stop lighting piles. Or if it's a broadcast burn, you can just decide, to only light small sections of the forest.
Very interesting. So what kind of, you're giving us kind of a sense of the kind of fire management that we're doing in the forests around Santa Fe. Is that right? I mean, this is, you're sort of describing what we're doing?
This is what's been going on in the watershed for at least the last, 15 years or so. Since, since about 2001, when the city and the forest got together and decided that, there needed to be something done in the watershed to protect the watershed. But there hasn't been a whole lot of activity outside of those boundaries. And I think that's what we want to accomplish with the Greater Santa Fe Fireshed Coalition is, let's look at the rest of the area on this whole side of the forest so that we can, protect Santa Fe, not just protect Santa Fe's water source, but also protect Santa Fe's, tourist economy and the forest health in those areas. And then all those communities that are downstream from these areas, like Tusuki and Cañada de los Alamos and Glorieta and Tusuki Pueblo, and all the communities that, are at the base of those watersheds that they live in.
Now, every forest is a watershed for somebody, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the way that these different watersheds are interacting with each other, there are municipal boundaries and then there are ecological boundaries, which presumably aren't the same.
Right. Often, those are not well aligned.
Right. So what are your, picking up on what Porfirio is talking about, what are the kind of big picture goals and perspectives that you guys are looking at right now?
So the way I see it, the Forest Service, the Santa Fe National Forest, and the City of Santa Fe Fire Department correctly identified the municipal watershed as a very important area for a great majority of the population in Santa Fe. It provides over 40% of our drinking water. And so they focused there, and there's been a lot of good work that's happened there. A lot of the thinning that we just talked about in Ponderosa Pine, a lot of the progressive fire management with the ecological objectives has happened there. But we have lots of values in this broader area. Some of them relate to firefighter safety and public safety. Porfirio mentioned all the downstream communities. We have a lot of people living in these narrow canyons. And we know that after a high-intensity crown fire, like in Colorado Springs has experienced in the last 5 years, there is massive flooding events, and those cause a lot of damage and is a huge risk to human safety. So we have people living in areas that potentially could see a lot of damage after a fire, even if the fire isn't near there. So we have these, we have our municipal watershed and we have these other watersheds. But what we're seeing now with these forests of continuous canopies that are very close together is that wildfires cross watershed boundaries pretty easily. And we need to be thinking at the scale of wildfire, not just the scale of an individual watershed. And so that's really what this effort is about, is we need to think at the right scale, and we also need to think about our values on the landscape. And so Porfirio mentioned the tourism economy. You know, we have a lot of money invested in jobs and in second homes and in recreation, all on this landscape, from the ski basin to the Santa Fe Bike and Brew Fest that's happening in a few weeks, where tourists are coming to ride bicycles or in the Santa Fe area. So we need to be thinking about all those values.
What is the geographical area that we're talking about that goes beyond the Santa Fe watershed?
So in thinking about those values, we put a line on the map, and that line probably isn't perfect, but it really tries to capture the mountains around Santa Fe. And so that's what we're calling the Greater Santa Fe Firesheds. Starting from the north, it includes the En Medio drainage and includes Chupadero, the ski basin, wraps around Santa Fe to the south, and kind of ends at Glorieta and the community of La Cueva just next to Glorieta. So it includes a big portion of our mountains, and that boundary doesn't imply that we want to thin and burn everywhere. We want to just be thinking about how fire behaves in that big area that has all those diverse values we just described. But we want to be strategic and focused with where we may thin or where we want to propose burning. But it's the big landscape that we're looking at.
How much of that landscape is wild right now? I mean, are there houses everywhere, like some little house in the forest surrounded by 50 acres kind of thing? Or are there places that really are wild and could be treated as wild landscapes without the danger of hurting somebody?
So it's an interesting question. You can do thinning and burning right near residents and home if that's what is determined by the site and the landscape. Just this past winter, the Forest Stewards Guild, my organization, we burn piles near homes. So you can do it where you need to do it. I think broadly speaking, we're in a nice situation where a majority of our ponderosa pine forest is just uphill from all the communities. A lot of people live in the pinyon juniper forest, which, while it still has a fire risk, it's a slightly lower risk than the ponderosa pine. But we have a lot of opportunity to do strategic thinning and prescribed fire.
Does fire tend to travel uphill or downhill, or is it entirely the direction of the wind?
Well, so fire generally will burn faster uphill, but wind will trump almost any topography. So it is influenced by the topography as well. So through saddles and really narrow canyons, the wind tends to get speed up because it's being shuttled through a narrow passage. And then in broader landscapes, like on ridge tops and open meadows and plains, it tends to slow down. And then the trees also help to mitigate the wind as well and kind of shelter areas from how fast the wind is blowing. But really the wind is a big driver of what the direction the fire is going. And especially here in the Southwest, you can see a lot of fires have this, when you see these burn scars, there's these narrow kind of long burn scars where they're not very wide. You know, they're probably twice as long as they are wide, if not more. And it's because they're just being driven by, you know, a big windstorm. And then when the wind dies down, the fire kind of just tends to try and spread out and burn more in a circular kind of pattern and following topography, be more influenced by the topography. But wind is a big factor in the direction of fire.
For you, Porfirio, as a fireman, what is it like to witness a fire? Because on the one hand, if you're firefighting, it's your kind of enemy. On the other hand, it is this like force of nature that's very natural. Like, how do you see it?
So there's a real difference in how structure firefighters see fire, you know, attacking a home and burning a home. When you're trying to just drown it out, you're basically trying to put as much water as you can on a structure fire, and you generally have a lot of water to deal with. When you're looking at wildland fire on the natural landscape, you don't have the luxury of water because there's not enough water that you can drown in, you know, even just 1 acre, let alone, you know, 10,000 acres or 100 acres. And then, and you're using fire to fight fire. So you're, you know, understanding how fire works and you're lighting fire along your control lines back into the main fire so that you're consuming fuels and you're not having to be directly right next to 100-foot flames. I mean, in general, a human being can get relatively close to a fire that's maybe 4 feet tall. And anything bigger than that, there's no way you're going to be able to be effective at fighting a fire that's bigger than that, has flames bigger than that. You need to back off farther away, maybe 100 feet or 200 feet away, and start doing indirect attack where you're lighting, you know, creating control lines and then lighting fire back into the main fire so that you have some control of how, so you have some safety involved in that.
We're talking to Eitan Krasilovsky, Xander Evans, and Porfirio Chavarria about the Greater Santa Fe Fireshed Coalition. Now, when we talk about coalitions, there's a lot of different members, and I think collaboration among those members is a big piece of this whole story.
Yeah, you know, we're really trying to think about things across boundaries in this landscape. So we have a lot of partners involved, and let me just try to name them so that everyone, all the listeners can get a sense. So we have New Mexico State Forestry, Pueblo of Tizuque, Santa Fe Watershed Association, the City of Santa Fe Fire Department, of course, and the Water Division from the city, Santa Fe County, the Santa Fe National Forest, both the Española and the Pecos Ranger Districts, the Nature Conservancy, the Forest Stewards Guild, the Wildfire Network, the Santa Fe Pojaque Soil and Water Conservation District, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, New Mexico Forest Industry Association, the USGS Jemez Mountain Field Station, and the New Mexico Forest and Watershed Restoration Institute.
That's a lot of people.
Well, and it's really important because just like the lines on the map, there are a lot of different ownerships, a lot of different managers involved. There are a lot of different interests. And we've learned as a community that if you go in and say, oh, we're going to do this on our land and make a kind of dictatorial statement, that's doesn't fit with the way progress works. If you bring everybody together and come to some consensus, yeah, it takes longer. Yeah, the meetings can be slow, but you get to a more sustainable solution. And just like there are lots of parts of the ecosystem, whether it's ponderosa pine trees and the understory flowers, there are lots of different parts of our human ecosystem, and everyone brings something to the table, whether it's an acknowledgement of the spiritual importance of wilderness or the fundamental importance of having clean water in Santa Fe. Those are all connected, and we need all those voices in order to make this really a long-term holistic plan.
And the long-term holistic plan has a goal of healthy forests and healthy human communities, if I understand it correctly.
Exactly. We have these fire-adapted ecosystems that we talked about, and as a human community, we need to be a fire-adapted community. We need to recognize the risk that we live with, take steps to mitigate that risk, and be ready to adapt to changes in our landscape.
When you have that many groups working together, I think something interesting happens, which is not that I've necessarily witnessed it directly, but you know, talking to folks who are doing things that involve fire and water and ecosystems and land and wildlife corridors and all of the things that are really important to a state like New Mexico, it becomes a situation where you have, yes, groups that are looking out for whatever it is that their interest is, but also groups that are looking out for the greater good and eventually are all kind of trying to work toward that. What does it feel like when you're in the process?
Well, one of the things I've noticed is that there's so many things we agree on, and there's so many overlapping things. For example, yes, I work for the Forest Stewards Guild. I'm a forest ecologist. I think a lot about fire and maintaining natural ecosystems. But I'm also, you know, a member of some other groups and enjoy hiking the Pecos Wilderness. And so I may find myself, you know, really rallying around a particular idea from the Trail Association. Or I know Eitan is a big mountain biker. So even though you don't, as an individual, you don't just have one particular issue that you always want to push.
You know, living in Santa Fe, living in close proximity to these mountains, which we're all passionate about, you know, you can't help but not mix these things from your life and your work. And, you know, I would go mountain biking the trails behind Santa Fe. I'd find all these fire-scarred trees along the trail as I'm huffing and puffing, pedaling uphill. And it got me thinking, oh, my God, how many fires have these forests missed? And it gets my brain churning a little bit.
That's such an interesting question. How many fires have these forests missed?
And not one that we can say exactly, but certainly a number of fire cycles, particularly in, say, Ponderosa Pine, that has a very frequent fire cycle, have passed. And so you can't exactly say, oh, there would have been a fire this year. But we can say with high degree of scientific certainty that they have missed fires. And that's less true as we get up into the spruce fir, where they may not have missed any fires. And so they may still, there's a scientific concept of the historic range of variability. And that's sort of how much nature has changed from what it was historically. And so the spruce fir may be still within that range, but we know based on lots of studies, particularly in New Mexico and the Southwest, but also around the country, that these forests are outside their historic range of variability. And it's like, as a scientist, I can't help but mention that pinyon juniper is much more difficult. There's still some things that we need to figure out. We know a lot about ponderosa pine. We're fairly confident there. There are other ecosystems where there's still some study left to do.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm just going to say outside of historical range of variability means out of whack.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. The event is called What is a Fire Shed? It's happening this Thursday, the 12th of May at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center. And many of, if not all of those that you read on the list, will be there, certainly many representatives, to talk to people. What's going to happen? Why should people come?
So I think folks should come to learn and to have a conversation. This is not going to be a super formal event. It's not going to be PowerPoint slides and presentations. It's going to be a discussion. We're going to have information booths set up around the room. And people are going to be able to go to a booth that interests them. And there's going to be a booth around fire ecology, talk to fire ecologists, the people that actually do the science and figure out our out of whackness, as you say, and as I say too, and fire adapted communities, talk to homeowners that have taken the steps, worked with Porfirio on projects, learn about New Mexico's land use history from a historian, talk to fire managers and firefighters, learn about firefighter and public safety, and when can firefighters go into a fire and when is it not safe for them to go in. And finally, Xander is going to be there to talk about climate change and a little bit about what we know and what we don't know about the future of our forests.
What do we know?
Well, we know it's likely to be hotter and drier. We're already seeing that. It's already, every year we get the feedback that it's been the hottest month or the hottest year. And so one of the other things we know is that our best hope for healthy forests in a warming and drying climate is actually a restored forest, back to that concept of that historic range of variability. So by bringing the forests back more towards what they were, say, in 1800, will make them more resilient or more ready for a warming and drying climate. There is obviously a lot of variation. I mean, I think this April, nobody knew that this April was going to be as wet as it was. So there's a lot of uncertainty about any given month or year, whether it's going to be wet or dry. But the long-term trends are unfortunately fairly clear. And so we need to take those steps to get ready for a situation that is going to be hotter and drier.
I wanted to ask before we go, have the two of you witnessed fire, like the kind of fires that we're talking about? I mean, we're talking to Porfirio, who's looking at it as a, you know, a firefighter, as a professional, but, you know, as a scientist, as a person beholding, because I've never, except for that horrifying fire in 2011, I was, what was it? Was that Las Conchas?
Yeah.
I was driving back from Albuquerque and it was like looking at the apocalypse from the highway. But closer up, many of us have not seen that kind of fire. What's it like?
So that kind of fire is, I think, universally scary to all humans. I mean, those are, you know, 500-foot flames being carried off the mountain, you know, amazing amounts of energy being released. So that's scary. Now, when you get down to the small lightning strikes that we've been so good at putting out, I have a couple of experiences doing that as a firefighter for the Park Service, and that is the kind of fire that you can get up close and you can dig your line right next to it and put it out. And it's really fascinating to watch and to see where it moves and what's driving it and how things are consuming. It's a wonder.
And for me, I'm actually relatively new to putting fire on the ground, but experiences with prescribed fire, it's amazing that this tool can, fire managers are very good at keeping it in control and knowing where it's going to go and planning their ignition so that it burns at the flame lengths and the temperatures they're expecting. But you can't remove that just fascination, that just the beauty of the flames, and particularly in that very controlled context, much more like your fireplace or a bonfire, where you know that there are safety zones and there are precautions being put in place, you can really enjoy the dance of the flames. And there is a direct human connection that you can't escape.
How do you start a fire on purpose, a prescribed fire, in an area that's not accessible, where like a roadless area?
So it's definitely a challenge, but you start with planning. There is a template that everyone across the country uses from the National Wildland Coordinating Group, and you need to have control features. They don't need to be roads. They can be trails. They can be rock outcrops. They can be stream courses. So you can use all these natural fire breaks. And then if you need to dig a fire line, which is usually about 18 inches wide, kind of like a narrow footpath, you can dig that at the end of the burn. You can put all the material you took off back on and rehabilitate it. So you start with control features, and then you look at your fuels, you look at your terrain, and you determine how many resources you need, how many firefighters, do you need equipment, do you need backpack pumps, and then you think about your ignitions. And like Xander said, the patterns you're going to use to ignite, and how you're going to use the wind to ignite against the wind, or different techniques. So it's really a kind of an art and a science. And we have a lot of highly trained, very skilled fire practitioners right here on the Santa Fe National Forest and across the country.
Well, once again, the event is this Thursday, May 12th at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center, 5:30 in the afternoon. What is a fire shed? Eitan Krasilovsky, Xander Evans, and Porfirio Chavarria are with the Greater Santa Fe Fire Shed Coalition. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.